And a good day to you. Welcome to another edition of The Front Page on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Chuck Meraz, and today our guest, you probably heard him this weekend on Health Matters, Dr. Tony Weaver, who stops by once a month and spends time with us today on The Front Page. Tony, welcome back.
Thanks, Chuck.
I know that the first thing you wanted to start off with was some information about something that's an upcoming event regarding health and insurance and things of that matter.
Yeah, this is, I think, very important for people in the Morehead area. The Miriam Fordham, who's the director of the Division of Healthcare Policy Administration for the state of Kentucky, and is, I believe, as best I can tell, in charge of the Health Insurance Exchange for the state of Kentucky, is coming to Morehead to the Center for Health Education and Research. That's the big new building that's right across from St. Clair Medical Center on January 29th. January 29th. Now, from 11 to 1, they have a session for that's really geared for healthcare providers, administrators, boards of directors, community agencies, patient navigators, and managers and frontline staff. This is geared toward people who are delivering healthcare from 11 to 1. Then at 5:30 to 7:30, there is a general public session. It's free. It's open to the public. Question and answer session with Miriam Fordham, the Director of Healthcare Policy Administration, about the Health Benefits Exchange. They'll have on-site insurance sign-up assisted by their connector people. They'll have free snacks. And
that's the whole reason to go alone.
They will have free snacks. No advance registration. Just show up January 29th. 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., and again, it's at the Center for Health Education and Research, the Share Building. That's on 316 West 2nd Street, right across from St. Clair Regional Medical Center, the new brick building there. It's on the first floor. You walk in the door, and you're talking to Miriam Fordham about Health Insurance Exchange.
Are you able to preview the snacks? Do we know what we're going to be having?
You know, I'm looking at the – and it's sponsored by St. Clair, St. Mary's, Our Lady of Bellefonte, Highlands Regional, UK Healthcare. But, you know, there's some key information not there. And isn't that the way with health insurance exchanges? Sometimes the
There you go.
I don't know if we've got accurate snack information. I don't know if it's been verified.
Well,
but, I don't know.
I'm just wondering here, because it's put on by a medical organization, if it's going to be some of that healthy snack stuff, I may not show up. But if we're talking about like King Dongs and Little Debbie oatmeal cakes, I mean, I'm there.
Well, I, as a person who regularly snacks at medical institutions, if it falls in line with most of them, I guarantee you there will be something worthwhile to snack on. I agree with you. You know, the carrot and celery plate only gets me so far at 5:30 in the afternoon.
Well, this sounds like it will be rather comprehensive, Tony.
Yeah, it gives you a chance. First of all, you know, you get to hear what this is about. And I can't stress enough to people, this is a very complicated thing. You and I have talked about it, I think, on the last time I was on your show. This is very complicated. The way it is being implemented is a little bit different than a lot of us understood. There will be ripple effects and side effects coming off this for many years. It will change the way medical care is provided. So having a person who is knowledgeable about Kentucky's exchange to answer questions, and free snacks. You just really can't beat that. I'd recommend everybody come 5:30 January 29th.
And I guess the last point, I like the fact that they've divided this up into two separate modules, one for professionals and providers and things of that nature, and then have one for the general public. I think it's important to kind of divide those two up because they have different needs.
Absolutely. You know, and there is a, let me tell you, there is a great deal of uncertainty among providers as well. Uncertainty about how people are going to sign up, how we know people are signed up, when there is a grace period and how we're going to be doing our billing and so forth. So this is very, very important for the healthcare providers. But the 5:30 session is all for the general public. That is for the healthcare consumer and should be a very worthwhile session, January 29th, 5:30 at the Share Building.
And today you've also brought us what promises, I think, to be a very fascinating topic. We'll be talking about brain death, and I guess it's also just in time for the start of the spring semester here at Morehead State University.
Well, the coincidences just abound on this one, but it came out. I've been following these cases and not really thinking a lot about how to put them together. The New York Times had an editorial, actually, January 9th, and it's worth a read because it's where I got some of my information about this. These are very strange cases. You know, first of all, Kentucky statute. This was back in 1986, but it hadn't changed. There's two ways that I can determine that a patient is dead in the state of Kentucky. First of all, if they have no breathing and no circulation. That seems obvious. If your heart stops and you stop breathing and I can't get it restarted, we can't get it restarted by any means, then we would pronounce you dead after we tried doing CPR and all that, or if we found you and you had no heartbeat and no breathing and we couldn't restore it. That's one way. The other one is something called brain death. If I can, or the hospital can, get your circulation and your breathing maintained artificially, whereas we've got you on a breathing machine, we've got some medicines or pacemakers or things like that that can keep the heart going, then we look at brain function, and we have some ways to determine that the brain function is absent. Now, we're not talking, and I want to make sure your listeners understand, this is not about being in a coma. It's not about the cases that you're aware of, like the vegetative state cases, Nancy Cruzan, Terry Schiavo, those kind of cases. They have brain function. They are in a coma. They are not responsive to their environment, but there are brain waves on the brainwave tracing. They have reflexes. They're able to breathe on their own. These are people who have no brain function whatsoever, and in recorded history, no one has ever recovered from that. So that is brain death. So either the heart stops beating and you stop breathing, that's one way, and we can't restore that. Or if we are able to restore it, but the brain shows no function whatsoever, at that point, that's called brain death.
I'll ask you about that brain function. What types of measures are used to see if there is a functioning brain?
Yeah, three elements. This is fairly simple. It's anywhere in the country. This Kentucky statute hadn't been changed because this is in all 50 states. First of all, I've got to make sure there is a cause. You know, you got to have something. That is, if suddenly you fell to the floor and I couldn't figure out what's going on, then I can't really make a decision because there might be something that I don't know about. But then I got to look and make sure you're not on some drug that depresses your brain function. High doses of barbiturates can depress it. Or let's say we find you under the ice and you're not breathing. The old thing that I learned in medical school was you're not dead till you're warm and dead. That is, a hypothermia can artificially depress brain function. So we got to make sure there's nothing going on like that. And that sets the stage then for determining it. We look at the cranial nerves. There are some nerves that have reflexes that relate to the brain function. So if I were to touch your eyeball, you would blink. So I can take a piece of cotton and just touch your eyeball lightly, you will blink. So that's the corneal reflex. We put a tongue blade in your throat, and most people will gag. There are some people that don't have that reflex. For instance, sword swallowers, if you think about it. If you're a sword swallower and you gag, that's not going to go well.
Well, yeah, one of those little sticks is kind of a walk in the park at that point.
Yeah, so we'd have to look at the eye reflex plus the gag reflex. And then the final thing is we do something called an apnea test, and that's when, if you're on a breathing machine, we turn off the machine. Now, you may not be able to breathe on your own. Many people have difficulty breathing on their own. They have a big pneumonia or some type of condition with their lungs, but they'll make an effort. So if you have, essentially, there's nothing else that I can see that's causing this problem, you have no signs of reflexes, and when I turn the breathing machine off, you make no effort whatsoever to breathe, then not only are you not able to think, but your brain is not able to do the simple things it needs to keep your body alive. And what's further, if that happens, then the brain can't regulate your temperature. It doesn't cause your body to flush when you get hot. So we'll see temperatures, you know, 106, 110 in people who have brainstem death. And things really go to pot after that, which is one of the reasons that that nobody survives that. Now, you take the case of Ariel Sharon. He was in a coma because he had a massive stroke. He had extensive brain damage, but he still had a functioning brain, and he survived, what, was 6 or 8 years?
That was 8 years, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, so you can have extensive brain damage. You can be in a coma. You cannot be able to respond to your environment, but that's not the same as brain death. So that's what we got. That's how we determine it. Now, the cases, I'll just give the particulars.
These are very interesting. I want to point that out before you get into it, and there's also the moral aspect of this, and I mean, it's just really, really fascinating.
Right. First one, 13-year-old Jahi McMath, in California, December 9th, had a surgery to try to treat sleep apnea. After the surgery, had some very, very serious complications of bleeding, and wound up being declared brain dead. That is, this child had surgery. She was on a breathing machine after the surgery anyway, and she was in the hospital, so the doctors were able to keep her heart functioning. But unfortunately, due to the problems with her circulation and the bleeding problems, she wound up being brain dead. She had no brain activity by the brainwave tracing. None of those reflexes were present, and she was warm, and she was not on any drugs to depress her brain function. So they declared her dead. That's, you know, you signed the death certificate and all that. The family objected. The family is a very religious family and felt that that as long as she had a pulse, then that's proof that she was alive. Her heart is beating, so she must be alive. I am certain, again, hospitals are not allowed to release your records without your permission, so the hospital really can't comment on this, but I am absolutely certain, having been myself in situations like that with families, that you sit down, you explain all this to the family. It was explained, but the family clings to that hope that that a miracle could occur and this child could wake up.
Now, Tony, I'll ask you really quickly. There is no artificial means being used at this point to keep the child alive? Is the child, I guess, has a pulse on its own and is continuing to breathe on its own?
No, because remember, that's one of the criteria for brain death. So this child is on a breathing machine, and every time they turn it off, the breathing stops. Now, they can. They're using some medicines to keep the heart going, but probably the heart would go on even if they stopped the medicines. They're just maintaining the blood pressure and the heart rate within human range right now with the medicines. Family went to court. Says, well, you need to put in a feeding tube. You need to send her to a long care facility because we want to wait for the miracle that we believe will occur. The hospital said this person is dead. We don't put in tubes or do procedures on a person who is dead, and we certainly can't. There is no facility in our state and really no facility in the country that will accept her. Now, there are some, you know, you can always find some facilities willing to do things, and the family found one. That facility has not been named, but they actually what happened the sequence was that the family went to court. There was an arrangement made. The hospital would not do procedures on a dead person. It violates their ethics, but they did declare the person dead, presented the family with a death certificate, and released the body. At that point, the family took the body and took the body to a facility that apparently will maintain the body or the child for a while. It's not a stable situation. My medical opinion is this child's going to have a very rough and bumpy course, and eventually the rest of the body will catch up with the brain and die.
I was going to ask you about the feeding tube issue. If the child is not breathing on its own, is it capable at this point of even digesting any kind of food, whether it's, you know, liquid or whatever?
Yeah, it's really hard to say. In order for the brain to die, bad things have to happen. So this child, after the surgery, must have had a period where the heart was not functioning, not circulating blood to the brain, and probably not to other organs as well. So I am certain that there is deterioration. I've seen sometimes there will be a significant recovery of other organs without the brain recovering, but for the most part, you know, they took a hit as well. So, like I said, it's possible that the gut could be in good enough shape to take in nutrition. The heart could be good enough to beat for a while. Without the brain there to regulate things, you really, really need your brain. I mean, more than just, you know, for enjoyment of life, you need your brain to maintain life, to maintain your temperature, to maintain your heart rate and things like that. So it's a long-term, it's a losing proposition medically. But this family is hoping, I think, to keep her body alive long enough for a miraculous thing to happen, which their faith tells them will happen.
Hmm. Have they set any kind of deadline themselves on this situation?
Well, there's nothing out there. As a matter of fact, the last report, I just checked back up on this this morning, was they reported they saw her move. Sometimes you can get some muscle twitching, again, even after the brain function is gone. And so they're maintaining their hope. Her body's been moved to some other facility, so there's no one else right now making any reports, and the facility's trying to maintain a low profile because this obviously would be kind of a mess if word got out. I don't think that's a long-term situation, but it's I do think, you know, it's interesting to me because when you think of people, us as spiritual people, I think most Christians feel that we are only on this earth for a short time, and the miracle occurs when we actually reach our spiritual reward, which is not on this earth. And I think it's a bit of a twist of the Christian religion to say, well, I want to keep this body alive as long as possible because that's how the miracle is going to occur.
Boy, how tough is this on that family? I was just thinking about this. They don't want to let go, and I understand that because they love this child, but at the same time, hanging on to something that appears to be lost in the end could almost be more painful. Then you talk about the ethics of the people who've taken the child in to artificially keep it alive, and I wonder about that too as well.
Oh, there's so many. I mean, let's spin it around. I've been kind of talking as a physician, but talk as a family member. Here you are. You see your child there. The child has a pulse. The body's warm, but the child doesn't respond to it. You want the hospital to do more to help the child, and the hospital refuses. They hand you a death certificate. They tell you you're on your own. They don't make any effort to try to transfer the child to a different facility or anything like that. How can that not be jarring? And then I think what they're going to witness, again, flipping it back around as a medical person, what they're going to see going forward is going to be very, very, very discouraging.
It sounds like a story that will be back in the news before long.
This one, the death process may finish quietly. That's what I hope, and I hope they will come to that realization. But, I agree with you. It's the story is still ending.
We'll talk about the second case here in just a moment. We're on the front page today with Dr. Tony Weaver here in Weekends on Health Matters on MSBR. We're talking about brain death today on the show. I'm your host, Chuck Mraz. More in just a moment.
Support for MSBR comes from the Community Recycling Center in Moorhead. Funded in part through a grant from the Kentucky Division of Waste Management, a second green recycling trailer will be rotating among Elliottville, Hayes Crossing, Farmers, and at the MMRC Fire Department on Kentucky 801 North. In addition, a green recycling trailer will always be located across from Walmart in a parking lot at the community park. The rotating trailer schedule is online at moorheadrecycling.org.
Hey, I'm Chuck Mraz. Again, our guest is Dr. Tony Weaver. We've been talking about brain death. We were reviewing a California case here moments ago that really brought up a lot of moral and ethical dilemmas for all those involved. And Tony, you have another case that's also extremely interesting.
This was a 33-year-old woman. Her name was Marlise Munoz. She's in Fort Worth, Texas. She was 14 weeks pregnant, and she collapsed on her kitchen floor. This was back in November. It appears she had a blood clot in her lungs. CPR was performed, but they were unable to get her heart restarted in time, and she suffered brain death. And again, it's all those criteria we mentioned. She has the reflexes are absent. She makes no effort to breathe on her own and does not interact, move, or anything like that. So all brain function has ceased. She was 14 weeks pregnant. Now, the Texas hospital said, well, you know, there is a statute. Texas has a statute that says, by the way, this woman did not want any heroic measures at all in the event of a terminal illness or the doctors felt she would not survive. She had signed statements to that and made statements to her family to that effect. The hospital said, well, we can overrule that because she is pregnant. And Texas had a rule, even though she was 14 weeks pregnant, the fetus, the baby would not be viable outside her. They said, well, since she is pregnant, we can overrule her. Now, it starts to get murky. The statute mentions a terminal illness. It does not mention what you do for a person who is dead, and she meets the criteria for being dead. So at this point, despite her wishes, despite her family's wishes, her body is being maintained, and I'll read her father's comments. He says, all she is host for a fetus. I'm angry with the state. What business did they have delving these areas? Why are they practicing medicine up in Austin, which is, I guess, the state capital is what they're mentioning. So the hospital has interpreted terminally ill laws to apply to people who are actually dead. To maintain the fetus. And we talked about it again before the show, Chuck. At 14 weeks, you know, they've got to get that baby up to, I guess, 30, 32. Now, I'm not an expert on neonatology, but that's where I understand. So it looks like, you know, she's going to have to be in the hospital for several months. her body will have to be in the hospital for several months to grow this baby. Now, the other part of it, there is no way to determine how badly the baby's brain was damaged during the time that she was damaged. That is, the baby may be in the exact same shape that she's in, but we can't do reflexes on a baby, on a fetus inside the mom.
Well, I'll ask you this question. Can her body, which, as you mentioned, is brain dead, support a fetus because it has to obviously circulate nutrients to this infant? And I'm just wondering if it's possible. And as you mentioned, the other key part about this is there's no guarantee that the fetus will be alive when they decide to deliver it in, what, 16 weeks?
Yeah. First of all, just like the other one, there will be deterioration, no doubt about it. I'm certain if the events were serious enough to cause brain death, her heart, her kidneys, her intestinal system also took a hit. The question is, can they keep her going, keep her body going long enough to deliver this baby before that deterioration sets in? And just like I mentioned with this young girl, you can't maintain that. I've seen people where, you know, the families asked me to keep going. The person wasn't brain dead, but was seriously compromised, and things just started getting farther out of equilibrium. It's very hard to maintain. So we know you'll have to artificially maintain her temperature because her brain doesn't do that. You have to keep her on a breathing machine. You have to hope that the kidneys and the gut will hold together and she won't get an infection before this baby delivers. And this is in opposition to the family. So here we have one family that will not believe their child is brain dead and wants to continue. Here we have another family that is ready to accept it, and the state will not allow them to accept it. So you can see, I mean, this is a very convoluted issue. I have no answers. I am fascinated by this. I've certainly witnessed a lot of people who died. I've pronounced people. I've used these brain death criteria, but I've never seen anything like this.
Well, no, and I was thinking about it. Say the baby lives and is born and everything is okay. I mean, it's got to be really difficult, again, on the family. I mean, here they know they've lost this woman, and there's no going back. At the same time, the state is saying, well, we've lost one life. We don't want to lose two if we don't have to.
Yeah, I understand where they are. It goes beyond, like I said, I understand with the terminal illness, with a person who is still alive and still able to experience life. The other thing that they mentioned is actually this has happened before. People's bodies have been maintained to deliver a child with the patient's and the family's wishes. In this case, though, at 14 weeks gestation, the duration of time, I think, is as long as anything I've seen, and the family expressly did not want this to happen and were overruled. It looks like probably $1 million to $1.6 million, $1.5 million to maintain the woman and to deliver the assuming this child is it had no damage at all, but is just being born extremely early, it will still require time in a neonatal ICU to develop its own lung function and so forth. Hmm. So they'd be looking at an extraordinary expenditure. It's not clear if you expend that much money on a person who is dead. You know, you think everything down, just simple things like who gets the bill for this, and how do you bill for a person who the hospital, I will say, and this I think is a little disingenuous, the hospital informed the family she was brain dead but has not signed a death certificate on her body. And so, once again, I think we're in a really murky area. There are right-to-life groups that feel that this is absolutely the correct way to go, and there are protests on both sides outside the hospital going on right now while the hospital people are continuing to maintain her body.
That's another story that I'm sure we'll see more news on as we move forward, because in both cases, something we'll have to give at some point or another. And certainly the one thing that we can say about all this, Tony, is we wish the best to both families in a situation like this. And like you, I can't say that I have an idea, a recommendation, or even a thought as to how to move forward, because this is really uncharted territory.
It really is. I will tell you, my own personal philosophy, after seeing all this, I'm just looking for a graceful exit here. You know, I am frankly, for my own personal self, if I wound up in a condition, I heard this once, Chuck, when I was a medical student, and I wrote it down, and I've lived my life by this. This was at Vanderbilt, the Children's Oncology Unit. They said every child should have some joy today and some joy to look forward to tomorrow. And I have lived my life. That's the way I feel for any of my patients. If there is no joy and no hope of joy in the future, that is, people can be in pain. People can have immense suffering. But if family's there to comfort them, they see grandchildren, they are able to participate, that's one thing. But when there is no joy and no joy in the future, it's really time. That's really my religious approach to this.
Well, Tony, thanks as always for stopping by and joining us for Front Page. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Chuck.
And again, our guest today here on Health Matters on the weekends here at MSPR, Dr. Tony Weaver. I'm Chuck Meraz, host of The Front Page. We'll see you next time.